I am constantly begging my people to stay calm and do nothing that might make things worse. Voting against the Emperor right now would be a total violation of that request. Gorman cannot take the risk. I'm sorry, Mom.
All right, welcome back to, what's our podcast called? We're not talking about Chandrilan weddings today. We're talking about Andor Season 2, Episode 4, which I actually wrote down the name of this time, which is Ever Been to Gorman? Question mark. So the, as always, I'm joined by my good friend, Jason.
Yo.
And my other good friend, Douglas.
Hello.
And the episode starts... Did anybody write down how the episode opens? Because I thought it was kind of interesting how it starts. Anybody else catch it? I'm going to assume from your dead silence and
it's 1 year later. It's BBY3.
Okay, so that's true. It does start and it says after the Andor logo scrolls by, it says 1 year later. Like we said last time, the episodes are going to be in three episode chunks and they're going to be separated by a year. And so the year on this particular episode or this chunk is BBY3. So 3 years before the Battle of Yavin. The interesting thing I thought was that the episode starts with a very out-of-focus shot, and then it slow focuses over like 5, maybe 10 seconds on like a mixer board. And then at the end, once it gets all focused in, a hand comes in and presses a big red record button, I guess. And then that's it. And then it fades out, and then we get into the Cassian Bix stuff. So... I don't know if maybe that, I mean, clearly there's more to that, I assume, later. There was not anything else about that in this episode, at least unless you guys picked up on something I didn't. It was just kind of a weird throwaway scene, I guess, of this mixer that was...
Yeah, I vaguely remember that, but it didn't register. Kind of a cool intro shot, I think.
Yeah. All right, so we're going to break up the episode into plot lines. First plot line is Cassian and Bix. We see Bix wake up in the middle of the night, and she's in bed with Cassian, so they have escaped from where we saw them last time, and they are living happily in, well, maybe happily is the wrong word. Yeah, they're living on Coruscant in an apartment. Bix wakes up in the middle of the night. She grabs a gun. She heads out into what their living room and sort of starts reliving this like PTSD kind of fever dream of some interrogation where an Imperial was executed. But it is worth noting that they are on Coruscant, so they have, in essence, gone into hiding after they're using the largesse. That's the wrong word. They're using the size of Coruscant just to blend in instead of hiding on some small planet. Cassian gets out of bed and basically talks Bix down because she has this gun kind of pointed in the middle of the room because she's got this PTSD thing going on. He basically, you know, calms her down, takes the gun away from her. So we're just reiterating the fact that Bix has some mental trauma that she's still dealing with.
I mean, this is a good example of what we were just talking about, how Tony Gilroy sort of just throws it at you and doesn't really explain things, because the soldier that Dr. Gorst is like interrogating in Bix's dream there is apparently it's the soldier that Cassian killed on a previous mission. They argue about it later.
Yeah.
They argue about like Cassian. It's not something we've ever seen. We don't know that character, apparently. But this is like a mission, this their previous mission where it'll come up later, but Cassian apparently had to kill this soldier. He was fairly innocent, maybe, and Bix was very thrown off and disturbed by Cassian's quick to kill actions. So anyway, that's who that guy is in the chair who apparently died. But Dr. Gorst
he died under interrogation. They didn't straight up execute him. They were kind of interrogating him and torturing him, and his body gave out. Was the impression that I got.
Yeah, apparently. It wasn't like he got the same treatment that she did with the torture.
So the line, like you said, it starts, and there's no explanation for what you're seeing. We don't recognize these characters. But it is later in the episode, you're right, Bix kind of lays into Cassian. I mean, probably 15, 20 minutes later, she starts laying in, and then you get this backstory that you don't have when you first see that scene. So that's a Tony Gilroy way of showing you, not telling you what happened.
But it's also kind of confusing. Like, you see this guy, and you feel like you're supposed to know him, right? They make it seem like you're supposed to know this guy, but I don't know.
So later in the episode, they argue, and Cassian, he's telling Bix, he's like, I had to do it. And his quote was, you put the uniform on and you take your chances. He was an Imperial threat. You and I are here now because he's dead. It had to be done. So Cassian doesn't necessarily feel remorse for this. I mean, he's like, yeah, I killed that guy, but I didn't have a choice. He was a bad guy. He, in essence, forced my hand. Let's see. So Cassian and Bix are living on Coruscant. They're in hiding, kind of. They go shopping for fruit at one point, and the shopkeeper says to Bix, oh, I haven't seen you in a month. And, like, Cassian's, like, immediately, like, his hackles go up. He was like, oh, man, this guy recognizes us from a month ago. Like, this guy knows we're here. You know, he could compromise us. So there, Bix and Cassian are living in an apartment that I got the impression is kind of like a shared apartment that some of the other rebels, like Luthen, has put together this apartment.
It's a rebel safe house.
There you go. That's a better word. Hmm. So she was like, I wonder who's lived here before or who's going to live here after us. So, yeah, that's a good point. It's a safe house. So they are, again, in hiding. We see Bix looks out the window and it's raining. And Bix has got a case of cabin fever, I guess. She's not kind of digging this undercover life in this big city. She tells Cassian that she wants to go for a walk tomorrow. Go for a walk in the park, I think is what she said. And Cassian says, yeah, I don't know if we can do that because there's cameras over there. Bix's line, she doesn't like living in hiding. And her line is, if I'm giving up everything, I want to win. We have to. So she's not happy about this lifestyle that she's living. So if she's going to make all these compromises, it's for her, it's kind of a go big or go home thing. And then I'm just trying to see how far down the episode we go. We see Bix is up in the middle of the night a couple days later, and she's looking out the window at a building way across the way that has a flashing light on the top of it. Again, Cassian gets up kind of to comfort her, and she points out that this light is flashing and it doesn't normally flash, so I assume that's some sort of signal or something that's not explained in this episode. Later, Luthen sends Cassian on a mission to go investigate another guy. So before he leaves, they have this weird kind of like hand sex scene. What did you think of that? Was I the only one that thought that was weird? Like they kind of had this weird sensual hand, like, I mean, it almost looked like they wanted to dance, but they weren't. It went on for a long time, like them just kind of like touching each other's hands.
I really liked it in so far as just the creativity in even intimacy in the world is, you know, you can experiment with why don't we do like intimate things with our hands?
Why don't we have more hand sex?
Why don't we have more
hand sex? Is what I'm hearing.
Or at least like, you know, this may be a version of intimacy that's sort of done. Maybe this is like a Star Wars BJ, you know, who knows?
Oh my gosh. All right. So
if there's an expectation for hand intimacy though, doesn't it start to become just a hand job?
Last thing we see of Cassian and Bix after the weird hand sex thing is Cassian leaves to go on this super secret mission that Luthen sends him on. And Bix is again looking out the window. It's raining, it's nighttime, and she takes a little dropper out of her pocket and puts some drops under her tongue. My first thought was like, oh, she's taking antidepressants or something. But upon further reflection, I think she's pretty much just self-medicating with whatever.
We don't really know much, do we?
Or whatever. I mean, no, I don't know. But she's clearly very unhappy and depressed and has PTSD. And the last thing we see of her is her putting some sort of drops in her mouth, which I assumed were drugs.
So I think you're right. I think one of the things that Tony Gilroy has done really well with this thread, this plot line, is one, it's very relatable. We can understand why she's feeling traumatized. We can understand why she would be self-medicating. We can understand her listlessness of just sitting around. So it allows us to connect to her as a character and feel a little bit of what she's feeling. But then the other thing that I appreciate is, and maybe it was just me, but I kind of picked up a little uneasiness, like, oh, she's discontent right now. Tacoma was discontent too.
Oh.
And look what ended up happening to him. Is Bix on that same line? Is she going to be eliminated because she's a threat?
She's barely holding it together.
Bit of a loose cannon.
With Cassian there, like talking her off the ledge and comforting her when she's having bad dreams, and now her support system is gone. Oh, it's worth noting that Cassian asks Luthen, can I take Bix with me on this mission? Because he doesn't want to leave her there. And he's shot down. Like, no, Bix needs to stay here.
Right.
So she's kind of in the worst possible scenario for her. So,
I mean, the undertones of that is Luthen is sending away Cassian, her protector, and leaving her there on the same planet as Luthen. Is Luthen about to come in and clear up some loose ends? Or is he going to take her out? That was the... I wouldn't go so far as to say implication, but there was certainly a concern that something like that might be possible.
It's also worth noting, like you pointed out, and I didn't really put two and two together until we started talking about it, she has nothing to do on this planet. She doesn't have a job. She doesn't have family or friends. Like, she's kind of just sitting in that apartment twiddling her thumbs all day. And that's probably pretty hard for a person like Bix. I mean, she was a mechanic, right? She's probably, anyway, it's got to be really tough to be in a stressful situation like that with nothing to do all day except sit around and think about it.
You might as well do some drugs.
I was just going to say, other than hand sex and drugs, right?
But yeah, I guess I took a similar take from you, Doug, or basically... We're starting to see some separation in their relationship. We're starting to see a fracture there in their ideas of what the rebels require, what the rebels should be, what their participation in it might need to be. And we know Bix is not in Rogue One, so I mean, I think it's a pretty obvious assumption to assume something bad happens to her.
Oh, I haven't even thought that far ahead yet, but that's a pretty safe, huh? Okay.
Spoilers, jeez.
Yeah, on this movie that came out 10 years
ago. It's a prequel to a prequel to
it's a spinoff of a prequel. Note. Yeah, right. All right, so that's the extent of Cassian and Bix. Their plot line ends with Cassian leaving on a jet plane and Bix taking drugs.
Sorry, just one more point to add to that. I think the other thing that this whole plot line really shows us and calls into question is, where are Cassian's loyalties? Is he loyal to Bix, who he's been with and definitely demonstrated loyalty all through the first season, or is he loyal to Luthen now? And the episode makes us question that, because clearly she is in a state where she's not doing well, and Cassian sees that, and he still takes the job and still goes away. Where are his loyalties now?
You're right. It's worth noting that Cassian was hesitant about taking the job. In fact, I think when he left Luthen, he was like, what does he say? This is not a yes, or I haven't agreed yet. It wasn't like Luthen snaps his fingers and Cassian jumps and goes and does it. It was a reluctant agreement, but yes, that's a
Luthen,
good point.
As he's walking away saying that, Luthen's like, oh, yeah, and grab me some soda when you get
yeah,
go there.
Right.
Like,
pick up some chips on the way back, right? I know you're going to do it. Yeah. All right, the next plot line, we see Gorman, and there is the town, city, whatever, is called Palmo. We see a scene with what I assume are some rebels, and they're sitting around a radio, and they're basically listening to a call between Cyril and his mom. The rebels, or whoever these people are, I think we are led to believe later that they're local Gorman uprisingists.
They call them the Gorman Front.
Okay. They're terrified of the mom, of Cyril's mom. They're like, she's crazy, like, let's not get anywhere near her. But they think Cyril is perfect. The line was, we have to run this down. So Cyril and his mom are just talking about, you know, mom and son stuff, but they're really interested in talking to Cyril. So we know Cyril is being surveilled, and they are interested in him.
Well, it's kind of a little more interesting in that Edie, his mom, is sort of spouting the imperial propaganda about Gormans being like bad and oh, these people, I wouldn't give them any money to go visit you. And he's fighting against that. He's saying, you know, he's telling her, I think you're watching too much Fox News.
I wrote that exact thing down. I'm like, so she's basically watching, anti-Gorman Fox News, and she's saying that this place is terrible, and he's saying the opposite. He's basically like, hey, I'm living here. These people aren't that bad. There's nothing crazy going on. Whatever his job is, he's like, I'm just counting gorlectopods, Mom. I'm not, planning to overthrow the government.
Yeah, he says don't trust imperial media too much. So it's pretty cool, pretty intricate situation because we know Cyril knows he's being surveilled, or at least he suspects it.
He says yeah later.
And so is this all an act, that he's putting on with his mom in order to get their attention and to make this infiltration? Yeah, so it's really cool, really well done.
Interesting. It's worth noting that Cyril, the scene starts off with Cyril getting dressed. He's in his fancy dress clothes, looks like a military uniform. I mean, like, he looks extremely buttoned down and well put together. And he uses like this dental floss on his door to create a sensor of whether or not somebody has entered his door or not. I totally lost my train of thought. Why was Cyril? That's what it was. So Cyril is on Gorman in this, I assume, imperial apartment that they put him up on while he works on whatever he's working on, and Daedra is not there. Okay, we find out later that Daedra is still on Coruscant, and we'll get into that in a minute. It's worth noting that they are not together at this moment. So, yeah, we already talked about his mom watching Fox News, and basically he talks her down and says, that's propaganda. Don't believe what you watch on TV. As he's walking to work, he lives close to where he works, so there's several scenes of him walking around the city. There is a protest against the Empire outside of his office, and they must know who he is. They've seen him walking back and forth a couple times, I guess, and they're surveilling him. This one, street salesman comes up and says, hey, man, you want to buy a spider? And he, pulls out this big, gigantic tarantula-looking spider thing, and he was like, no, I've told you before, I'm not interested in this. And the salesman basically forces it on him and says, you really want this one, take it. There's basically a secret message inside of it. So when he gets home, he opens up this spider and it has a small piece of spy paper, a strip of paper, which has an address on it, we assume, which he then eats. I don't know if you noticed that, but there's an address that he consumes it, so there's no evidence that he ever had this. He goes back to work after hours. And they won't let him in his office. Like the security guards, they scan his ID and they're like, basically, no, you're a day employee, not a night employee. You can't come in here. It's worth noting, did you see that the guards were watching pod racing on TV?
Yeah.
So there's nothing going on because it's whatever, 10 o'clock at night, and they're just the night watchman kind of thing. So right before Cyril shows up, it shows them watching TV and you hear pod racing sounds, which I thought was a cool nod.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
So they decide they're not going to let him into the office because he's not authorized to be there after hours. Cyril bluffs about having left some papers on his desk for a big presentation tomorrow. They ultimately let him in. The guard basically says, you got 5 minutes, make it really quick. I'm not supposed to let you in here. Somehow he has enough time to get into the building and get to the quote unquote safe room. And he calls Daedra on some super secure encrypted channel, and he lets her know. He's filling her in on what's really going on Gorman. Basically, he says, I know I'm being watched. I know they broke into my apartment because of the dental floss thing. He's like, I know I'm under investigation. So it's worth noting that he calls Daedra back on Coruscant. So she's still in their apartment on Coruscant. They are far away at this point. Anything about that, you guys, before I move on?
Just thought it was a nice bit of, espionage, spy craft, double crossing, and
Okay.
Well, and Daedra's very dismissive. She doesn't think he's gotten far enough. He's really subservient to her, it seems like, really trying to impress her. And that dynamic comes across pretty well.
The other thing I noted was that there's one scene where he's walking back to work, I think, and he's holding his nose, and I think a garbage truck drives by. So I think the implication is that he's kind of living in the slums, like that perhaps Gorman is not the upper crust. So it's probably he's probably having a hard time adjusting to that. He's used to living on Coruscant, which is a little, and they have a nice apartment, and his life is very sterile. So I imagine that he's very much outside of his comfort zone.
Well, but before that, he was in that apartment that was deep down in Coruscant, right? Which was like slums at that point, but maybe his lifestyle, okay. he's gotten accustomed to his Daedra lifestyle.
Daedra is.
I will also just point this out. The practical sets that were built for Gorman were, holy crap, impressive. Like, the budget for this show, a big portion of it went to building the
town. I couldn't
tell
how much was, CG and how much was sets, but there was some cool spiral stairs and lots of...
Totally.
You're right. It was a very cool-looking city. It was very well fleshed out. It is a big-ish city. I mean, certainly not as big as Coruscant, but...
But even the elements of Coruscant that you see in this episode, they're very different. They feel different. It just looks so realistic, and just the set pieces are so awesome. I mean...
Yeah, whoever was in charge of the set design just... Home run
and
knocked it out of the park.
For sure. I mean, in all the episodes, right? And the costumes.
Well, all of them for sure. But I mean, like, certain parts of Coruscant are real, actual places, like where Luthen does his little secret exchanges and stuff.
You can feel it's real locations. I mean, I think there's definitely CG filling, like, backgrounds and stuff, but. The places they're walking and talking and sitting,
you can feel it. Real.
It looks real. It looks lived in. It's not just a matte painting on the background.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
We see Cyril decides to go to this meeting with this address he found inside of this spider. He walks into this, I don't want to say a secret meeting. I mean, it is. I guess it's mostly open to the public. I don't know. I guess you have to know the address to get in. But it's basically a town hall debate about how the Empire is crushing Gorman's legitimate businesses. There was, a bunch of Gorman spice miners and silk farmers or whatever, basically saying that the Empire has come in and, I don't even know, raised taxes and shut down this. But legitimate business people are up in arms because the Empire is slowing down their business dealings. Most of this takes place in a foreign language. It sounded to me like French. I don't know if it's supposed to be Gormanese or what, but it had a very French sound to it.
I got more Italian. Like, they're all really well dressed, and like clothes is a big deal in their industry. They're all like super well dressed. The fabrics and everything look. I don't know. I was really impressed. Not just the setting, but the clothes in this.
Well, their whole economy is based around textiles. So.
Yeah, the.
Oh, I guess that's a good point. The whole deal is the spider silk, right? So right. Yeah, okay.
So
right.
I got very Italian tailor made kind of vibes with like the language and stuff. I don't know.
I'm really curious if that was legit French or if that's some other language. Anyway, I mean it's all subtitles.
They had subtitles.
We see Cyril, he walks in, he listens to the crowd, he's kind of trying to feel out what's going on. Are these the good guys? Are these the bad guys? What's going on? And at one point, the town council tries to calm the crowd down, like, hey, we need to hear from some more people, but the crowd is not having it. They are riled up. They hate the Empire. They are not happy. We find out later that Cyril is introduced to, I guess, the main leader of this little town council. And I wrote down his name in another place. I don't remember what his name. I'll find it later. And they kind of feel him out. They know that Cyril's working for the Empire. He was basically like, hey, I know you work for the Empire. I don't know if you're on our side or you're on their side. I don't really care. He basically says, will you write a report? ? He's like, are you going to write a report about this? And what are you going to put in the report? And I thought it was a really interesting Tony Gilroy way to tell the story, because he doesn't tell him what to write. He doesn't say, hey, we're all just out here trying to farm spider silk. He lays out the scenario of the Gorman people. He says, 16 years ago, Grand Moff Tarkin killed 500 unarmed Gormans in the middle of this plaza. That they're all in the middle plaza of this town, I guess. And the Empire is now building a large building in the middle or near this plaza, which will cast a shadow on the memorial that they have built for these 500 Gormans, that innocent Gormans that died. And they had an agreement from the Empire that they would not cast a shadow on this memorial, that they would leave this memorial intact in respect for the Gorman people. And the Empire's building this building anyway, and it's going to cast a shadow. And then on top of that, they're also starting to believe that whatever this building is either going to be an army or a military base, which is double disrespectful to this memorial of these innocent people that died. So that's the story that he lays out for Cyril about the history of this town. And again, he doesn't tell Cyril what to say or what to write in his report, but he says, here's the story. So if you write a report, can you maybe just like throw in that, hey, we're not asking for anything special. We just want you not to be dicks to our memorial after you killed all of our people.
Yeah, I feel like that's an accurate summary.
I thought it was a really good way, a good type of storytelling of, I guess in that sense, it is telling, not showing. But
it is also showing, and we know the subtext of this. We know from what Daedra said, what you need is a group of rebels you can count on to do the wrong thing at the right time. So all of this is being teased. They're essentially trying to rile them up, trying to antagonize this local group of rebels so that they can push them at the right time to start an uprising.
They want to have an excuse to come in and
all of
take
this,
control of Gorman and get the Kalkite or whatever it was.
Exactly.
Yeah,
okay. All of this like needling at their little memorial and stuff, that's just pushing them towards rising
Interesting.
Up.
Okay.
That's how fascists work.
Yeah. That's everything that that's the extent of the Cyril storyline. It ends with this town hall and this, you know, the leader basically pleads with Cyril, like, you know, please, if you're going to write a report, just put that story in it because we're kind of getting screwed here.
Did you notice the memorial? Like, it's like a fractured column. It kind of looks like two towers. Did you see that?
No, I didn't even notice the memorial was in this episode.
Yeah, it looks like a column that's like fractured into two towers.
Like 9/11 two towers?
Yes, very okay. Very.
Why would they have a memorial for 9/11?
I know.
They're not even in the same galaxy. And this was
long time ago, right. All right, so Cyril's storyline is over. Daedra has a small storyline in this. We see that Daedra is again in that round Imperial meeting room. They are, I don't even know, there's 20 of them, 30 of them in that room. They're having this big powwow of the high muckety mucks of the Empire, and they are discussing a bunch of seizures of ships and money that the Empire has been doing. They have been escalating their seizures, and military leaders basically say that we are arresting too many people. They can't even process all of the people they have in custody. We're arresting these people and saying they're terrorists. I don't even have the resources to interrogate them to figure out if they're really terrorists or we're just arresting people just to arrest them. Partagaz, I think, is the main guy. The guy that stands up and says that was like really hesitant to, you know, call out Partagaz. But he actually ends up agreeing with him. He was like, okay, you know what, that's a valid point. And then he ends the meeting and he walks away. And like several of the military leaders kind of like breathe a sigh of relief, like, okay, good, because I was just about to get chewed out for not doing whatever. So that, yeah, one
that
of the,
was Lonnie, right? Luthen's
yes.
Informant. Yeah.
Yeah. I did note that everything at this Empire meeting and the halls that they were in was like bright white, like bleached white, like almost like Daedra and Cyril's apartment. there's very little color. Not only is there very little color, but the entire thing looked like an operating room. Like, it's just super bright, and it just looked weird. I mean, it looks very Empire-esque, but it stands out. Like, there's no dirt anywhere. It's just flawless, pure white.
I would also point out there's no warmth anywhere.
Right. Yeah,
everything
yeah, yeah.
is cold. Their attitudes towards
sterile.
Everyone are cold. So it fits. It fits the motif.
After the meeting, Daedra catches up with Lonnie and says that she really wants to find Andor. So she's still trying to track down Cassian after the... Oh, what was the uprising called?
Ferrix.
The Ferrix uprising. That's still on her mind, even though she's working on something else. She says, if you have any information on Andor, let me know. I'll help you bring him in. I do not want the credit, is what she says. I just want to see this guy brought in. And she leaves and says, my door is open if you have any information. I wrote down Ronnie. Is it Ronnie or Lonnie? I guess it doesn't
Lonnie.
Matter. One of those. He ends up, the guy from the Imperial meeting, ends up in that elevator again, and he meets Luthen in the sewers. He tells Luthen that Daedra is running the campaign on Gorman, which seems very confusing to Luthen. Luthen says, because what's going on in Gorman, at least from Luthen's point of view, is just a big smear campaign. They're trying to paint this place as deadly and dirty, and which is why they're doing the Fox News thing and why Edie thinks that Gorman is a bad place for Cyril to be. So Luthen's comment is that a smear campaign is an opening salvo, not an end game. Why are they using Daedra? Because she's a hunter, this is not a good use of Daedra's skill. Luthen is very aware of Daedra, but he doesn't know why she would be running this campaign. And then he basically tells Lonnie, Ronnie, whatever, keep your nose and your ears open. I need more information on this so that I can respond. And Lonnie is hesitant, but agrees.
Well, I mean, it's also worth pointing out that last season, Johnny was like, I'm out. And Luthen was like, no, the hell you're not.
Right.
But I don't know. Ronnie's sticking around, so good for him.
The last thing we do see Luthen, we talked about it earlier, he sends Cassian on a mission to get an assessment of Caro Rylands, who's leading the Gorman front, but Bix has to stay on Coruscant. Luthen's line is, Gorman would be a remarkable place to turn our way. So if you're trying to start a rebellion, this place, Gorman, that everyone is telling you is so terrible, rising up against the Empire for overreach, would be a good start to their campaign. Anything else on that before I move on to Mon Mothma? I must say it was great seeing Luthen in the sewers again. Like, I got a little bit of chills because, like, he is... Stellan Skarsgård is so freaking good in the sewers, like, looking intense and calling out Lonnie and just, like... I mean, you can clearly see he's the puppet master. He's just a perfect casting for that character, and that scene is great.
It's fun when he... as a character, when he drops the facade and becomes the intimidating, scary...
Right.
Like, that was probably the best speech from, you know, the whole series, was his speech in season one when he's talking to Lonnie about, like, you know, I fight for a sunrise that I will
never
see.
Yeah, right.
No, that was epic.
All right, so with one other minor plot line, we see Mon Mothma on Coruscant?
I think so, yeah.
She's doing her senator thing. There's discussion of the PORD, which we do not know what it is yet, but it is essentially what the Patriot Act. The government has granted themselves some additional military powers to do whatever it is they need to do. So that's the implication of they're arresting too many people. They have this jurisdiction that they don't normally have. The PORD was never meant to be permanent, but the government is pushing for an extension. And Mon Mothma's line is, are we finding criminals or are we making them? And then she goes on to make some quotes about various different planets, peaceful planets in the past. You know, this planet's up 19% in arrests and this planet's up 34%. Like, you know, these are planets that have never had a criminal problem before. Like, are we clearly we're manufacturing this problem? Is what Mon Mothma's saying.
I think that that initiative was also what caused Cassian to get arrested in season one. That same.
Oh, you're right. Oh,
like yeah. The judge, I think, was like mentioning that.
Yeah, good call.
So Mon Mothma's doing her thing. She's talking to all of her senator buddies, saying this, you know, freaking extension of the PRID is causing me all kinds of problems. You have to help me stand up and vote against this. At one point, she says, I almost have the votes, but it didn't sound very convincing. Let's see. Crime is up even in peaceful places, but her friend doesn't want to rock the boat. Her friend from Gorman was like, Gorman is under way too much scrutiny right now. It would be bad news for me as a Gormanite to stand up against this. It would put too much pressure or light on me. And Gorman, so
yeah, he was the senator from Gorman, and like, if even she can't get him on his side on this, then like, who is she gonna get?
Yeah,
because apparently, I guess the statistics, it's even worse on Gorman, like as far as these arrests and stuff.
Yeah, if Gorman is just being ground under the boot heel of the Empire, and they won't vote against this, then yeah, what hope does she have?
And so when he says no, she's like resigned, and she's like, oh,
yeah, I'm screwed at this
screwed.
Point.
I will kind of say. It's frustrating how realistic that goes down. Like, you can totally understand and see that being a plausible reaction.
Yep.
And yet at the same time, come on, man. You're the elected leader. This is what you were elected for.
Yeah.
Stand up for your people.
You've
Show
got
some
one
backbone.
Job, dude. Right.
Yeah. If you don't stand up, who the hell is? I mean, obviously, rebels would be the second option there, but...
And it's so interesting because, like, yeah... The reality of whipping votes in the Senate is so real, and you know, I just got this idea, like a new insight into that process, because you're talking to all these senators, you're trying to push your initiative. All these senators are maybe like telling you they're going to vote for it. You don't necessarily believe what they're saying. You have to kind of estimate who's going to vote and who's not, and it's all this weird. Double speak and like
a lot of them are your friends too, right? Because at one point, Daedra says, "You know, come on, dude. Like, who was there when you needed, you know, help on whatever it was? Like, I bailed you out here. I bailed you. Like, we've been friends a long time. Like, I need you to come help me out on this, right? So, I mean, yeah. I mean, she's doing her job, which is to go and work with her Senate buddies, friends and enemies alike, to try and get this extension."
Yeah,
shot down, but it's not looking good.
I forgot. I wanted to mention that when she looks so resigned. This is kind of hokey, but like when she hears the senator from Gorman say, "No, I can't support it," and she sits back in her chair and she kind of just looks resigned. I feel like that was the same exact look, Kamala. Because there was a crazy picture of Kamala and Hillary Clinton sitting and watching the election results come in. They're just kind of sitting back in their chair, just being like, "Well, we're screwed.
What's happening? Like, is the yeah?"
I mean, I don't love them, but like, yeah, they have a clear idea of how screwed we are, you know.
But I think current events and the relationship aside. For Mon Mothma's character specifically, while she has financially contributed to the cause, she's definitely tried to work within the system herself. All of her plays have been within the confines of the political system, the game that she knows, trying to whip up votes, trying to introduce legislation and stuff like that. And at this moment, I think is one of the first, if not the actual first, but where she kind of feels like this is getting nowhere.
Yeah.
Like, this is clearly wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm not making any headway here. Like, this is not working. And maybe she's starting to consider, just maybe, it's time to go outside the system.
Well, she's already kind of done that with like funding certain.
Funding,
rebel,
yes. But as far as actually getting her hands dirty.
Real. Dirty and losing faith in the system.
That's probably a better
right there.
Yeah.
Like you said, when the Gorman senator says, "I can't help you," like that moment, I think is when she loses faith in the system. Yeah. Like, I've been doing this for so long.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's a powerful senator. She's got history. She's got culture. She's rich. I mean, like, if she can't do it, then literally no one can, right?
Yeah.
I mean, clearly this is all leading to, you know, what does it take to start a rebellion? I mean, how oppressive does the government have to be before somebody's going to stand up? Clearly, the answer is you can get away with whatever you want on Gorman. You can get away with whatever you want in Gaza. It's going to take a little bit more to get the people ticked off enough to really rise up.
Well, and I think that's a perfect showcase of it's not one big thing. It's a bunch of little things escalating, growing.
It's not black and white. It's, yeah, it's mm-hmm. a straw that broke it's the very camel's messy. Back kind of thing.
And
yeah.
we see the people, the true believers, the rebels behind the scenes at this stage, they're not all good guys, you know, and there's a lot of things that, you know, people probably like Bix who find things to be going a little too far for her tastes and she can't handle it, you know. It seems like she's going to be, if not just remove, you know, leaving the rebels, she'll be taken out, you know.
You know, actually, I mean, yeah, now that I think about that, because, yeah, her line, Bix's line was, if I'm giving up everything, I want to win. We have to. And then, like you said, she's not in Rogue One, so but she's going to go out with a bang is where they're leading this up to. Like,
juxtapose that line, though.
Yeah.
If I'm giving up everything, I want to win. We have to. With the first episode, that one Imperial officer who had turned and she was asking Cassian, like, is it worth it? And he was kind of saying, like, you've already won. By making this decision, you've already won. Hmm. So juxtapose that. Has Bix already won? Because she made the decision. She's fought the fight. It doesn't feel like she's won. Feels like she's lost a hell of a lot.
Yeah, her life is not in a good spot.
I still don't understand what she, I guess I understand what she means by that. I just want to win, but like, I don't know what the show is trying to tell me with her saying that, honestly. Like,
I mean, she's been tortured. Yeah. She's got PTSD.
Yeah.
She's in hiding.
She's all in.
She doesn't have any license over her own life. She can't go to, she wanted to go to the park with Cassian and he was like, no, we can't go out and walk in the grass because there might be cameras there, right? Cassian didn't want him to go to the same 7-Eleven to buy melons because the guy recognized him. Like, she's trapped in a cage and clearly very frustrated with
him.
All right, there's one last scene I want to talk about and then we'll be done. It cuts to a new planet I've never heard of before called Dakar. We see a cave, and we see Will from the farm planet. Actually, it was Will that escaped with Cassian and Bix, and he is in this cave, and we see, like, this slow walk-in procession, and Saul Guerrera shows up, and Will introduces himself as Will Mon. He's, like, trying to give, like, a fake name. I don't know.
No, his name's Willman.
It is.
Whole thing Willman? Just the way he said it, like he was like, Will, Ma. Anyway, okay.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Will is kind of his nickname. I think he was trying to present himself a little more formally.
Okay.
But it's always been Willman.
Okay. All right, so he introduces himself as Willman. Saw Gerrera says, do you have it? And he pulls the sheet off of this kind of like honeycomb-looking thing, which I'm not really sure what it was. Is it an engine or is it a generator? Saw Gerrera says he wants it for the quote-unquote unlimited fuel. And then he goes on to talk about Rhydonium and how dangerous it is. If you inhale it, it'll burn you from the outside. If you get it on your skin, it'll burn you from... No, the front... Anyway, inside, outside, whatever.
Yeah.
But basically, he's talking about how incredibly dangerous whatever this machine makes. It's making some sort of fuel, which I assume is starship fuel or whatever. And somehow it can make unlimited amounts of that. Saw Gerrera grills him, do you have all the pieces? Do you know how to make it work? And he was like, yes, no problem. I'm shipping out tomorrow, but I'm happy to teach your guy. You know, I can show him how to do it, and then I'm getting out of here tomorrow. And Saw Gerrera just kind of laughs at him. He's like, that's not happening, dude. You're going to teach my guy here. You're going to stay here as long as I want you to. We are introduced to Pluty, who will be Willman's student, and he's basically going to work with Willman to teach him how to use this machine until Saw Gerrera gets what he wants. Again, it was only supposed to be a day, so Woolman is a little perturbed, upset, confused about what his role is in this, because I think Saw Gerrera's reputation probably precedes him. I don't think Woolman wants to hang out with Saw Gerrera's group too long, because they have a reputation for being rough dudes.
Yep.
I mean, it's cool to see Forrest Whitaker in, I think, slightly less brain-damaged state than he was in Rogue One. Like, he was even more...
It's hard to tell.
...brain-damaged than that, but, like, he's crazy. He seems like he loves this substance a little bit too much, or he liked to smell that device, you know?
He definitely revered it. He was very excited to see it.
I get the impression that it's something that has affected his mental. It's like one of the reasons he's kind of effed up.
I kind of got like a little like Spice from Dune vibe from it.
Yeah.
You know, I was getting like Warlord and Fury Road type of thing.
Yeah, right. They're clearly, this makes unlimited fuel, but like it's also some sort of drug. I will note that it was great to see Forrest Whitaker. Like that guy, he's a presence in this episode. He's a presence as an actor. He's kind of a weird dude, but it just works. Like he pulls off like this creepy, I don't even know. Is he a mob boss? Like, whatever. He pulls it off. He's very intimidating in this. And he talks Woolman down and he's like, no, you're staying here until I'm done with you kind of thing. Anyway.
This is a great like set, like Tony Gilroy and the set designers and all of this. This is a great example of giving us the underbelly of the rebellion and like these organizations that are wheeling and dealing, and their priority isn't exactly, you know, for good. You know, they're going to make some money or they're going to do whatever. And but like Luthen has to work with them, and Willman is in a spot where it doesn't, you know, he seems very uncomfortable. Yeah, it's just a really good example of underbelly.
Does that come up? I mean, is that what they're going to do? Is make this fuel and sell? Are they going to sell space meth to fund this rebellion? Because if you're going to start a rebellion, you're going to need ships. It takes a lot of resources. So I wonder if that's where they're going. It's not just getting people riled up. Like you also have to have the resources to go with it to enable these people to go out and rebel.
I got the impression that the device helps them steal it. They're going to have to like pull a heist or something.
Yeah, they're more in tune with like pirate raiders than they are like rebels.
Yeah, Saw Gerrera at one point said, yeah, like you can get this Rhydonium and then we can go steal anything or we can go steal more stuff. Anyway.
Yes.
But I do agree that it's a fantastic look. In this episode alone, you've got Luthen's clandestine like operations as part of the rebel. And it's not an alliance yet, but that's what we're seeing, is that there is no alliance. You've got the foundations of rebels on Gorman starting to grow. If we rewind, in the previous three episodes, we saw the quote-unquote rebels who were playing rock, paper, scissors to the death. And then, of course, you've got Saw Gerrera's crew. All kinds of different factions, all with different motivations, all with different goals. Some of them just want to be left in peace, and some of them want to go pick a fight. So how do you congeal all of that into one unified alliance to stand up against the might of the Empire? And obviously that's what we're kind of seeing in the show, is how do you get from point A to point B? So it is nice to see that. Agreed.
It's
Forrest
nice to
Whitaker.
See how the sausage is made. It's not just. Messy. That's what we get in episode four, right? Like, there's already existing rebellion. They have ships. They have leaders. Like, that's not something that happens overnight. That's something that takes a lot of resources and time and people dying to, you know what? So in that sense, we are seeing how the sausage of a rebellion is made. And chef's kiss, I'm there for it. I'll start. We're wrapping up here. My review of this episode, 2 thumbs up, 9 out of 10. Great storytelling from Tony Gilroy. You flesh out so much more of this rebellion in a very organic way, you know, in a very realistic way. We were shown way more than we were told. I just thought it was a great piece of storytelling. I wish more television was like this.
Yeah.
Jason?
Yeah, I'll give it a 9. Yeah, I thought it was, I mean, it's like globe-trotting. There's so many different scenes or universe or galaxy-trotting. Like, there's just so many different environments that feel so real. There's just so much going on. The budget feels awesome. Like, they really put a lot of money into it. I would love to see this be the new Star Wars, or, like, this version of Star Wars be expanded, you know, to cater. I think it's getting a lot of good word of mouth.
Pretty sure they are expanding this version of Star Wars by having the show.
Well, it's this season, and that's it.
It's done
after this. They for sure that Tony Gilroy's done with this particular season. But this vibe could easily be carried on in the same way that, you know, a lot of directors set the precedent or set the tone and the setting for like a first episode of a series. You could base a lot of more properties off of this kind of vibe and setting and cinematography for adults who've grown up with Star Wars and who are older and appreciate a more adult, you know, story. So I would love to see that. Anyway, Bet, what was I doing scoring? I'll give it a 9. Did I say that? Okay.
9 out of 10.
I'm going to give it an 8 just because, while I do agree with you guys, fantastic writing, fantastic use of show, don't tell, and really an interesting peek at, like, all of the different pieces that are moving at once. It was the second episode in a row where I really wanted some action, and there just wasn't a lot of action. There were a lot of intense conversations, but I'm dying to see some blaster fire. I'm dying to see something.
There was literally no action. It's all very intense hallway conversations. You're right.
So you didn't think Cyril walking through the Gorman courtyard,
holding his nose from that garbage truck? Isn't what else do you want, dog?
I mean, that to me is pure action.
I know.
No,
I know that. You know, the model of this season is 3-episode arcs, and this one is the first in that 3-episode arc. So they have to lay the foundation down. I get that. You got to lay the foundation. Got to build the scene before the action pops off. But even so, I wanted action in the last episode. Didn't really get it. But I got weird action in the way of Mon Mothma drunk dancing at the end of the episode. Ooh, that was fun. But this one, I was kind of still wanting, and I didn't get. So, 8. I'm not going to go higher than that.
That's fair. Yeah, I mean.
Okay.
You're wrong, but it's fair.
All right, that's it. Logic Gate out.